So, Luke 12, verses 1 to 7. Meanwhile, when a crowd of many thousands had gathered so that they were trampling on one another, Jesus began to speak first to his disciples, saying, "Be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. There is nothing concealed that will not be disclosed, or hidden that will not be made known. What you've said in the dark will be heard in the daylight, and what you've whispered in the ear in the inner rooms will be proclaimed from the roofs. I tell you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who kill the body and after that can do no more. But I will show you who you should fear. Fear him who, after killing of the body, has power to throw you into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. Are not five sparrows sold for 2 pennies, yet not one of them is forgotten by God? Indeed, the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Don't be afraid, you are worth more than many sparrows." Well, good afternoon. I've got a little test for you this lunchtime, now, which excites some and makes others sort of fear a little bit. But it's a test that not all test matters, of course, in our household at the moment. Our 10-year-old is slightly obsessed with verbal reasoning and non-verbal reasoning and practicing for 11-plus type exams. And that's driving us all a little bit nuts. But those don't really matter. I have to keep telling myself that. They don't really matter, particularly when I can't do them. Actually, these things are a bit ridiculous. There was one paper about 3 weeks ago I just couldn't do a number of these questions. You have to, this is a tangent, by the way. But you have to, it's just cathartic for me. The 8 questions in 4 minutes, so 30 seconds a question. And I thought, this is ridiculous. So I brought it into work, gave it to the staff one lunchtime. I said, just 4 minutes, everyone. You know, to the collected PhDs and first class honours from Imperial College, bright crowd, no one could do it. I thought, this is quite interesting. So I took it in the evening to a group of about 25 people at church, again, a room of lawyers, bankers, surveyors, teachers, doctors. The highest anyone got was 5 out of 8. It's a ridiculous test for a 10-year-old. Anyway, that's just my thing. The problem when you say something like that is some people then go, well, can I do it? Can I do it? Some of you are thinking that, aren't you? Oh, go on, then, I'll do it. I'll get all of them right. Anyway, that test doesn't matter. I'm through that. I'm over that now. Some tests do matter. Here's a test. Actually, it's not my test. It's written by a man named Arnost Lustig. He was professor at American University in Washington, D.C. for a number of years. Clever bloke, PhD doctor, medical doctor, doctor, that sort of character. I guess more significantly, he was a survivor of Auschwitz. And he suggested a test of maturity. He wrote it in 1995, so 50 years after being liberated. And he looked around a US that he thought was self-satisfied and smug, declared itself as having defeated communism, and thought you have no categories anymore for what is good and what is evil. And so he suggested a test of maturity for the population. And if you don't pass this test, I don't think you should be allowed to drive. I don't think you should be allowed to vote. I don't think you should be allowed to marry because you're not mature as a human being. It was slightly emotive, isn't it? But here, do you want to know what it is? You do, don't you? You do now. Because the stakes are quite high. He put it this way. "I wish that all men and women, wherever they live on earth, would have to visit Auschwitz-Birkenau for a day, an hour, or even a single second, during the time when Hitler, Himmler, Eichmann were filled with pride at what they were doing, filled with pride at what they had commissioned the German architects, planners and builders to do. And here's the test. Can you stand there and declare why it's evil? Now, every one of us thinks it's evil, you would say. But can you say why? And if you don't have a good answer, I don't think you're mature. I don't think you should be allowed to marry, vote, drive, etc. That's interesting. You might think to yourself, well, that's a very abstract sort of test. But every so often you do need categories for good and evil. You've got to have them. And how do you define them? How do you decide what's right and wrong? It's obvious. Well, maybe it wouldn't have been back then. So you stand there. You manage to go into Arnost Lustig's time machine. You find yourself back there in 1945. and you meet Heinrich Himmler, and you say to him, what you're doing is wicked. And he says, we don't think so. We think it's very sensible to remove undesirables. But you can't do that. It's abhorrent just to wipe out of people on the basis of race. No, we think it's sensible. And we have the rule of law in Germany on our side. Technically would have been true. But the majority of the world say you're wrong. Well, we're stronger than them. And we will win. And then what do you do? And he's saying, well, how do you define what's good and what's evil? Or in 2015, people are reaching again for the language in the UK of evil. Increasingly, since the summer, David Cameron will speak of the evil of terrorism in those terms. And I guess we want to say that. As you saw, as a documentary on last week, My Son the Jihadi. It was very, very moving. Did anyone see that? On Channel 4, Sally Evans spoke about how her son became radicalized in the UK and changed, went to Somalia and joined Al-Shabaab and killed himself in a suicide attack, taking out the lives of others. But she said again, we must speak out against the evil of jihadism. Now, we want to say things are evil. We want that language. But how do you decide what is right and wrong? How do you do that? That's what I want to have a look at for a few minutes this lunchtime. Now, as Phil said, just for 3 weeks, doing something slightly different, throwing out some questions that I think make us want Christianity to be true. I'm not saying if you agreed with everything I'm going to say and Jesus would say here, it makes Christianity true, but I think you want it to be true. And there's a funny tension in all of us. We both want there to be no God, and we want to do everything our own way, and we don't have to answer to him, and yet we really do want there to be organized laws to this universe. We want there to be an absolute standard of right and wrong. We want there to be clear rules. And we kind of want both. We're schizophrenic in that. But in this whole area of what is good, what is evil, will there be justice? Emotionally, something deep within our humanity wants there to be a God and wants Christianity to be true. Let me throw out three things and we're done. First, I want to ask, what is evil? And then more briefly, you want to let Jesus define evil. And then thirdly, let Jesus judge evil. Okay, those three. What is evil? Let Jesus define evil. Let Jesus judge evil. Those, just those three. First then, what is evil? Now, if you're a Christian, it's easy. You say, God says, and off you go. God says, I've made all of mankind, men and women, in my image, and it is wicked to murder them. So you know, there is a divine lawgiver who has spoken into the world and says, this is true, this is false, this is good, this is evil. It's easy if you're a Christian to know what is good and what is not. No problem. But if there is no God, if there's no divine lawgiver, you have got a problem. Because it is just your will against mine. Your view against mine. But there are some events that make us cry out it's wrong. But what if others disagree? I read a book recently by a man called Vishal Magalvadi, which you spell for you afterwards if you want. He is an Indian Hindu who converted to Christianity. He lived in India most of his life. And when he became a Christian, he and his wife worked with the rural poor in India. And he's written a letter, essentially, in a book form to the West. It's called The Book That Changed Your World. And he says, you do realize in the West how wonderful it is your culture is built upon Christian ethics. We haven't had that in the same way in India. And you don't want to be like us. He gives lots of examples. He gives the example of Sheila. Sheila was the fourth child of a low caste family. And he meets Sheila when she's 18 months old and has been left outside the family hut to die. Mum, dad, three older children inside. He asks, what's going? We're leaving her to die. Why? She's not very well. Why do you take her to a hospital? It'll cost us money. Well, I'll pay. Go away. None of your business. We want her to die. So Vishal goes to the village elders and says, what's this? Tell them to let me pay for food and pay for medical care. And the elders say, you don't understand. You might do that and you might heal her and she might be well. But they have three older children. They have two boys who will work. They have one daughter who can cook and clean for them. They don't need any other children. Even if she's healed, they'll have to pay for her food until she's age 12, and then they'll have to pay for a dowry and go into a debt. So economically, it makes no sense for them to save that child. It is rational for them to let her die, go away and leave us alone. Now, I take it you and I look upon that and think that's wicked. To deliberately abandon your own child. But in that culture, it's sensible. It's a rational secular decision to make for economic gain. And how do you say to them, you're wrong? Because they reply, don't impose your culture upon me. You bourgeois Westerners. We're different. You have your culture, we have ours. What do you do at that point? If there's no divine lawgiver who says that is wicked, all you can say is, I don't like it, and I wish you'd agree with me. That's all you can do. And it emotionally, somewhere deep in our humanity, we think, that's not good enough. We want to say, that is wrong. Same way you want to go to Auschwitz and say, that is wicked. Not, I don't like it, you do. Well, I just have to agree to differ, won't we? We're not happy with that. We want a bit more. So what do you do? Well, if you lack a divine lawgiver, I guess the main alternative in the secular West is the idea of evolutionary ethics, that over the centuries, humanity's worked out as best not to kill one another, it's best if we get on, and we're all moving towards a harmony. There's a world consensus that we're moving to, and eventually we'll reach it. Well, really? I think of something what most people would be happy with. The UN Convention on Human Rights. Most people think that's a good document. Article number one. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They're endowed with reason, conscience, and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood. And we say, yes, of course. All men and women are equal. There are a couple of problems with that. One. Lots of people disagree with the UN Convention on Human Rights. Lots of people in the West disagree with it. Amnesty campaign to get it changed all the time. They just don't think it's good enough. They think it's deficient, particularly in the area of freedom of conscience with regard to fighting. They don't like it. Lots of Western academics would say it's just imperialism. Cultural imperialism, imposing our views on the rest of the world. I guess most significantly, large swathes of the Arab world disagree with much of it and say, who are you? Who are you in the West to impose your categories on us? So, for example, in 2013, a survey done in Pakistan, 88% of those surveyed men and women felt that a wife must always obey her husband in everything. Must do. 88% of men and women thought that. Are you going to say to the women, you're wrong? Well, who are you in Mayfair? What do you know of my life? Go away. In Bangladesh, 59% of men and women feel that family honour killings of women are entirely justifiable. If the woman does something that brings this family into disgrace, she should be killed, say 59% of the population, statistically. But you and I hear those things, presumably think, well, that's horrible. But they don't. And why are they wrong? There's no divine lawgiver. Why are they wrong? We're just different in how we see the world. You see where it matters? That's a problem, isn't it? The other problem is, are these things only true if humans agree on them? So this whole idea that we're moving towards consensus. Does that mean, everyone today would say slavery is wrong. The modern slavery act gone through and last year, it's a good thing. 250 years ago, most of the world thought slavery was fine. Does that mean it was okay then, but it isn't now? So if you went back in time, you'd have to say, well, most of the world thinks slavery is good, so it's good. Are you happy with that? Or do you think objectively, throughout history, because of men and women being made equal, it's obviously wrong? Because they didn't think that back then. You see the problem? Something's either true or it's not. It's either wrong or it isn't. It's good or it's evil. Surely it doesn't vary over time. All sorts of problems. If you're a Christian, of course, it's very, very easy. Like Martin Luther King, who could write from Birmingham jail when he was imprisoned for breaking the law and being criticised by Christians, even at that stage. He wrote, "You ask me, how can you advocate breaking laws, some laws, and obeying others? It's simple. A just law is a man-made code that squares with the law of God. An unjust law is a code that's out of harmony with the law of God." It's very simple, he says, if you're a Christian. You know what laws are good and which are bad, because God has said so. We know that racism's wrong. We know discrimination's wrong, he says, because God has said so. It's not complicated. Contrast that with the ever quotable, because he's consistent, Richard Dawkins. He was put in, "What do you do if a man three teenagers break into a house of an old man and kill him? Because he's old, and they're young, and they're stronger, and they just want his money." He replied, "I couldn't ultimately argue intellectually against somebody who did that. I could only say, in this society, you can't get away with it. And then call the police." So you can't say it's wrong, because survival of the fittest, you can't do that. You just say you can't get away with it. So it's funny, isn't it? If you don't have a God who says this is right, this is wrong, how do you have a cohesive society? Police, coercion, threat. So the only way you can do it. What is evil? You need God to tell you what is good and evil. Otherwise, all you can say is, "I feel that's evil," not "it is wrong." That's what you can do. Briefly then, what difference does it make as a Christian? Well, look, let Jesus define evil, first of all. Inevitably, some people say in this debate, "Oh, look, doesn't belief in God permit people to do all kind of loony things? You just need to turn on your telly and there's Islamic State beheading someone else because God has told them to do it." Well, yes. Religious extremism can be abhorrent. And secular extremism can be abhorrent. Of course, both can. The 20th century will tell you atheists, well capable, secularists, well capable of mass murder. It's just extremism, of course. It's a matter of if it's religious or secular. That's why you want to look at Jesus Christ. Because actually, it makes an enormous difference who your God is. The one who famously would say, "You can turn the other cheek." Who would say, let me quote Luke 6, "Love your enemies, do good to them, and lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Then your reward will be great. Be merciful as your Father is merciful." Of course, those are not just inspiring words. That's how Jesus lived his life. And that's why Jesus gave his life for people who had rejected him. So he died for people who hated him. He died for those who had ignored him. He gave his life for his enemies. See, having him as your God makes an enormous difference. And any worldview, culture, philosophy, faith, you've got to judge it by the people who follow what the founder says, not who ignore it. Let Jesus define evil. You need to do that. Any other definition is going to be perhaps a brutal one. And last, here we come to Luke chapter 12. You want to know that Jesus will judge evil. And here's one of the many places where Jesus is clear that there is a day of judgment. Let me pick it up on verse 2. Jesus would declare, "There's nothing concealed that will not be disclosed, or hidden that will not be made known. What you said in the dark will be heard in the daylight, and what you've whispered in the ear in the inner rooms will be proclaimed from the roofs." See, not arbitrary justice, not quick. We've got a bit of a backlog in the courts. Let's knock off a few this morning. Let's get through. Perfect justice. Every action seen, every word uttered, heard. Perfect justice will be there on that day from Jesus. And he will say, yes, that's heaven for some and hell for others, and that's a good thing. That is a good thing. Because again, deep within us is the desire. If there's a God, we don't want a God who dotes upon the perpetrators of violence in a grandfatherly fashion. Who says to an Idi Amin, who says to a Bashar al-Assad, well, you killed a few people, didn't you? But you loved your children, so that's okay. Let me affirm the basic goodness that was in every single one of you. No, we want wickedness judged. We do want that. Churchill, another one, never short of a bon mot, put it this way. He said, for me, the evidence that God existed was simple. I knew that there had to be a God because the evidence that God existed was the existence of Lenin and Trotsky, for who a hell was needed. You see what he's saying? I look upon some men and the wickedness they've done, the evil they've committed, and I think I can't tolerate the idea that you just get away with that, that you die and rot and so does everyone else. There must be judgment for you. Therefore, I have to believe that there's a God who'll do it. And I think he expresses the desire, the wish, the will, the deep-seated truth that's in all of us. We want that. We do want that. We read Luke 12 again, verse 4. I tell you, my friends, Jesus would say, don't be afraid of those who kill the body and after that can do no more. I'll show you whom you should fear. Fear him who after the killing of the body has power to throw you into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. Are not five sparrows sold for 2 pennies? Not one of them is forgotten by God. Indeed, the very hairs of your head are all numbered. What extraordinary encouraging words if you're a Christian in northern Iraq or Syria, who's lost their home, who's seen their children killed in front of them because of their faith. Justice is coming. It is coming. How very wonderful to know that. We want that to be true. We want there to be justice and people not to escape it. So do you see, we want there to be a God. Within us is the desire. We want Christianity to be true at one level, even if on others we want to reject it and don't want it to affect our own lives. We want there to be a God who has said, good, evil, and I will judge, and the wicked will pay, and this world therefore matters, and the suffering you've experienced at the hands of the wicked is not in vain. I know, I see, I count the hairs on your head, I observe what goes on in my world, and I will judge. What is your answer to Arnos Lustig's test? Can you look evil in the eye and say, that is evil, because objectively God has said so? It's the only thing you need. It's the only answer you can have, ultimately. That is evil, and you can have hope in your misery, because he'll judge it. But you want that to be true. Let me lead us in a brief prayer. Our Father, at one level, these are very heavy things, weighty things of a lunchtime. And they may seem distant to many of us. Some of us would have encountered real evil personally. And these things are not academic. They matter enormously in our lives. But for all of us living in a complicated world, we need to be able to say what is good, what is evil. And we pray we would therefore be delighted that there is a God revealed in Jesus Christ who we can trust. Amen.